okay. So, gee, I should start with a long list of apologies. The first one is that here I am, standing in front of you talking again. And as an organizer, I should keep my mouth shut. But sorry, I have the itch. I love to talk. I have the itch to talk about things I care about. I do want to talk. If you have the itch to talk more, we have plenty of time. We can. So I mean, yeah. I mean, that's me. Second. So okay, about okay. I'm really, really, really proud about the content of what I'm going to tell you about. I think it's really, genuinely, truly good stuff. It doesn't mean that I will do a good job, and therefore I apologize for that too. But anyway, the talk is a repeat, or I'm more or less repeating the handout, a talk given from a handout that I prepared originally, like for a conference in Vietnam, maybe a month ago, or more than a month ago. But the plan is to be interrupted, so please interrupt. And I don't know if the plan, the hope. So, you know, in Vietnam, I said it in an hour. If it takes an hour and a half here, good. And if it takes 7 hours, also good. And of course, you don't have to stay all the way to the end. Okay? So, anyway, so as often for me, but not in this conference, my talk follows a handout. I hope you all have a copy. And here is the abstract made graphical. So, in short, what I'm going to tell you is that a whole portfolio of operations, so a very, very, very large collection of operations, useful and meaningful, all can be embedded into a certain category whose morphisms, whose things of interest, the morphisms are the things of interest, all look like perturbed Gaussian expressions in finitely many variables, you know, more precisely, docile perturbed Gaussian differential operators. With composition rules that involve various operations with matrices and various things having to do with Feynman diagrams. Now, this is cool because it has implications both to quantum algebra and to, I don't know if there is another way to keep the door to, it should be closed, but then it's locked. So I mean, there is a way. Is there a way to? Okay. Thank you. So it has applications both in quantum algebra and in knot theory. And maybe the final bit that I should say is that all of this is happening for a very, very specifically algebra or class of Lie algebra, type of constructions made out of Lie algebras. And I will have to say a little more about these algebras as well. Dr. Dancho, there is a handout for you to pick up here. Okay? Good. You know, one thing when you repeat a talk after a while is that you don't actually remember all the plans you had. So I'm kind of puzzled. I'm looking at the hand, at my slides, and I barely remember what I meant. So I think this I already said. Anyway. thank you for coming to the CRM. Originally, we said thank you for inviting me to Da Nang. The talk is on this URL, and everything continues in some sense. Rosatzky and Overbay, and is joined with Roland. And you know, sorry, one final marketing, Big Delphine, there is a handout to pick up here. Okay, so, you know, a few years ago, when I gave this talk in Nazi Washington, in a conference in Washington, D.C., my abstract was much more concise. Whether or not you like the formulas on this page, they describe the strongest truly computable knot invariant we know. And I stand behind that, but behind it. Now it's fancier, but that remains true. Okay? So, okay, back to the abstract and in a little bit more detail.
What is this Rolfson table, or what's the layer that was mentioned in your...
So if you sorry, where is the mouse? Here. So if you restrict your attention to the strict sense in which it is stronger than anything else, than other computable things, is simply that it separates more. So if you compute it on all nodes with up to 12 crossings, and I haven't computed it beyond, I forget how many pairs it fails to separate, but less than Chovanov plus Homfli PT. Mm-hmm. And it's polytime computable. So the expectation is that, you know, in as much as computable knot invariants are concerned, of course you can speak about, you know, you can speak as much as you want about knot invariants that you can't compute. Okay? That's not the case here. So,
you mean that the UI invariant can distinguish muton, say, close to
No, in fact, it cannot. It cannot. But variants of it should be able to distinguish mutants, but not the variant I will describe today. I'm only saying it separates more than Homfli and...
And this current facility is expected to be computable like up to...
I'm not happy with the programs I have.
No,
now.
But
I'm happy with their size, but there are certain elements that I'm terribly unhappy with. My expectation is that we will be able to compute it for knots with hundreds of crossings. Okay.
And Alexander is computable for...
Alexander is computable for thousands of crossings. So this is still a step below Alexander. Okay. So what was I saying? Right. So just a word about what is the portfolio of operations that we are going to embed into this funny category, dopegdo. Okay? So it includes the following. So given, or for two types of algebras, U, so the classical U and the quantum U, it includes the multiplication operation, which goes from U tensor U into U. And just to say why is it relevant to us, to topology, in knot theory, or this corresponds to taking a tangle and sticking two of its ends together so as to basically connect the one end of one component to another end of another component so as to get but basically it's a part of composing tangles, okay? Then there is the coproduct, which goes from U to U tensor U, and again, this could be either the classical or the quantum, and the coproduct not theoretically corresponds to taking a strand, which is really a thin ribbon because everything is framed, and cutting it through the middle to make two parallel strands. It contains the antipode, which is more or less strand reversal, but not quite, yes.
So what was U again?
Either the classical algebra or the quantum algebra corresponding to SL2 epsilon, which I will define in a minute. Okay? Then, maybe this is the only square that is in doubt, but there is strong evidence that stuff will work here too. So there is a trace operation that allows you to close a closed component into an open, an open component into a closed component. Then there is the R matrix, which is simply the value of the crossing. That too is Dopedo. Then there are the values of the cap and the cap. Then there is the value of an associator. Then you see associators, when written in not necessarily invariant terms, are actually the product of, can be written as the product of four elements that are sometimes called J, sometimes F. They're the so-called twists. They are the analog of the Kashirao-Wern element in a slightly different context. So these two are the factor, and then a few more things. Okay, so just to say what is the scope. Here are the things I'm going to tell you are the factor. Next, what are the algebras? So the algebras are the universal enveloping algebra and the quantized universal enveloping algebra of a certain algebra that I will call SL2 plus epsilon. Okay? And what is SL2 plus epsilon? So if you look at the what exactly, more precisely, what are we doing? So here is a picture of the universe of four-dimensional metrized Lie algebra. So you see, a Lie algebra is really determined by its structure constants. The structure constants live in some high-dimensional space, maybe not so high-dimensional, but then they have to satisfy some equations, the Jacobi equation. So it's really some algebraic, so the set of all the algebras is really some algebraic variety. And here is a schematic picture of this algebraic variety. So it has the zero algebra, or the zero structure constant somewhere in the middle. And these correspond to the abelian Lie algebra. And it has like a generic point. If you take a random four-dimensional Lie algebra, it turns out to be isomorphic to SL2 plus a one-dimensional component. So like the bulk of this space is the algebra is isomorphic to SL2 plus a one-dimensional algebra. There is somewhere a subsurface, a sub-variety of solvable Lie algebras. And what we do is we take one of these solvable Lie algebras and we find a path of Lie algebras in the world of algebras isomorphic to SL2 plus one-dimensional, whose endpoint when epsilon is equal to zero, so the path is parameterized by epsilon, and the endpoint where epsilon is equal to zero is at this solvable Lie algebra. And then what we do is we tell you how to expand everything, so how to expand all of quantum algebra, essentially, everything that I said before, in terms of this parameter epsilon, and do calculations with it. So a comparable situation is if you expand around the abelian Lie algebra, and then you get Vasiliev invariants. So what we do is not quite the same, and in fact, well, in some senses harder, in some other sense, but at the same time maybe a bit stronger. Okay? So, now more specifically, you know, what are the algebras? So, of course, I could...
But then, like, can one compare what you're doing to the series invariants? What's the... is it unclear how they compare? Or not at all?
Well, we have an additional parameter in everything, and if which we do not expand. So, you know, we write everything in terms of sort of closed form formulas in a certain additional parameter, which you can call h bar. So basically, we will see expressions of the form e to the h bar, or e to the h bar times something and thing. If you will expand further, if you do what we do and then expand it in h bar, you'll get finite type invariants. So, you know, if you want, I really didn't say it, but h-bar measures the distance between this and that. Mm-hmm. Wait, am I telling you the truth? No, it's not, sorry, I think I'm not telling you the truth. This is not the same h-bar. Sorry. There is, what? Such a parameter exists, and I've lied to you about its name. Sorry, it's not h bar, it's gamma.
Right.
Sorry. Apologies. Okay, anyway, so I can be completely precise about what are the algebras, you know. So I told you kind of a schematic story, but at the end the algebras become completely concrete. So I could tell you where they came from, but perhaps it's enough that I will say that they are completely concrete and move on and tell you what we do with them, and maybe later come back and tell you where they came from. Yes, Roland?
Oh, they came from Tuesday's talk.
Yes, they came from Tuesday talk. That's true. At the very end of Tuesday's talk. But anyway, here, just to go over it very, very quickly, just so that the names are in your mind. So SL2 plus epsilon is a four-dimensional algebra. With four generators, y, b, a, x, subject to relations, commutator of a and x is x, commutator of b and y is minus epsilon y. Epsilon is this small parameter that we expand with respect to, and again, the lie I told you before, that there is an additional parameter that I'm omitting here for simplicity, but really we could have added here a second parameter, gamma. So a bracket x is equal to gamma times x, and then expansion with respect to gamma would lead to finite type invariants. Anyway, gamma is absent here. So, the relations continue, if you set T to be epsilon times A minus B, you find that it is central. If you mod out by T, what you're left with is a three-dimensional algebra, and you can check that unless epsilon is equal, so if epsilon is invertible, the three-dimensional algebra you're left with is SL2. Okay, so hence the name SL2 plus, SL2 plus epsilon. So it's a one-parameter family of Lie algebras, which when epsilon is not equal to zero, is really SL2 plus yet a further one-dimensional component. And then the algebras U that I was referring to above are either the classical universal enveloping algebra of of this SL2 plus epsilon, or it's quantized universal enveloping algebra. The quantized universal enveloping algebra, yes?
So there's a hat on CU, should there be a hat on QU as well?
So the hat here means completion, and QUs are automatically completed. So yes, if you want, there should be a hat as well. Okay? So there is the quantization, and again, we didn't go... The quantization comes from some Drinkfeld double procedure, and let me just write the commutation relations here, okay? So the commutation relations are, written here in full, and there is also a product and a coproduct, and again, they are written here, sorry, a coproduct, and in fact also an antipode, which I think is under the screen. I could derive all of these things, but I think it's better that I show you what we do with them. Okay? Good. So, that's why it was below, because I wanted to speak about it later. And there is also an R matrix that has an explicit formula, and again, I could derive it, but it's better that I tell you what we do with them. Okay, so I want to tell you about the right-hand side, about the category it is included in, first a few conventions. So, first convention is that given a finite set A, I will let Z sub A be a set of variables with one variable Z sub I for each I in A, and variables always come in pairs. So for each Z sub I, there will also be a zeta sub, so corresponding to Z sub A, there will be a set zeta sub A of dual variables, where the dual of Zi is zeta I. So that's, just keep this in mind. So we have always Latin letters and Greek letters, and they're due to each other. And the second convention is that everything converges. Okay, this isn't a convention, this is a statement of negligence. Okay? Anyway, so now I can tell you about dopedo, so the category in which everything embeds, okay? So it's the category whose objects are finite sets, and the morphisms from a finite set A to a finite set B are expressions F of the form omega times the exponential of q plus p, which you can view as a power series in variables that are Greek for the inputs and Latin for the outputs. So, you know, if you have five input variables and seven output variables, then these will be expressions of this form relative to 12 variables, some Greek, some Latin, and where omega is a scalar, q is a quadratic which is small in some sense, okay? So in all, but quadratic in all the variables, and p is a docile perturbation. So what does it mean? It means that P can be written as a sum of epsilon to the power k times pk, where if you look at the part which is proportional to epsilon to the k, its degree with respect to the Greek and Latin variables is bounded. Okay, it's bounded by 2k plus 2, whatever it is. Okay? And there are lots of footnotes, and I could go through the footnotes, and maybe I should go through the footnotes, but the footnotes don't change the picture. They're just like footnotes, they're asterisks, they're minor issues. So really, the variables have weights. They're not just, so each variable has a weight. So the scalars could actually sometimes be power series. There are lots of kind of asterisks to mention, but maybe I should do it later. Okay? So instead, I should say, oh, I failed to tell you how to compose. So maybe I'll go back and tell you how to compose. If you have two such expressions, so basically these expressions look like, you can think of them as they have inputs, which are Greek variables, and outputs, which are Latin variables. And if you have two such, you compose them by, if you have one such expression, I don't know, let's call it F, and another such expression, let's call it G. So this one has its own Greek inputs and Latin outputs. You compose them by turning the Latin outputs of S into differentiations with respect to their duals and acting on the inputs of G and then after you act, you set all the remaining variables to zero. So this just amounts to saying a summation over all ways of choosing which C will kill which zeta. Okay, so complete pairings of the Latin outputs of F with the Greek inputs of G, and that's equivalent to say, completely equivalently, I could have said, let's turn all the Greek inputs into differentiation and let them act on the Latin outputs of F. So these are the two composition formulas written here. Either you look at F, you replace all the Latins by differentiations, differentiate G and substitute all the remaining variables to zero, or, the same.
You go first.
Okay. Anton, yeah.
So could you recall why just for the Gaussians, why is it a manageable composition?
I will not recall, I will show. I mean, it's a debt, it's not a... Yes.
But it's really dual pairing, right? There's some kind of dual? Greek is dual to Latin?
Yeah, I mentioned... Yeah, that was part of the convention. So each Latin letter has a corresponding Greek counterpart.
So why do you write it as differentiation? Is there some deeper reason for this?
Oh, because it's pairing. Yeah, it's a different way of saying pairing. But, you know... pairing is a sort of, if you want to express pairing as a formula, one way to do it is to say differentiation. Okay?
And things converge by convention.
And things converge by convention, yes. And also by the fact that every time I will do it, I will write a formula for the answer later. Okay?
So it is similar to the differential operations of open Jacobi diagrams.
Yes, 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 yes. Yes,
this is with record colored by variable G and zeta, and then combine them as all possible ways.
Yeah, this is, I mean, a lot of it is standard, a lot of it is related, we're not reinventing the wheel. Okay, so even before telling you, so I still owe Anton an answer, why is the composition manageable? Okay, why is this composition manageable? But even before that, I want to highlight why this is particularly valuable. So basically, in standard quantum algebra, you end up looking at representations of the algebra you care about. And if you have an operation with inputs, with a set of inputs, sigma, and a set of outputs S, then the operation is a tensor in V dual to the power sigma tensor V to the power S. And the size of such things grows really, really, grows exponentially in the number of elements of sigma and S. Okay? However, the number of quadratics, so I mean, for us, what replaces this space is the space of all quadratics, I don't know, let's call it Q, in variables sigma and S, and or the variables corresponding to sigma and the variables corresponding to S, and the quadratics are just matrices. So this grows quadratically in the number of variables, which is way, way less, and hence it's much more efficient. Now, this is for the quadratic part. Then there is the perturbation part. So the perturbation part, if you restrict your attention up to some fixed power of epsilon, is described by polynomials with a bounded degree. And again, polynomials with a bounded degree, the number of such polynomials grows polynomially. And so it's in principle much more efficient than using representation theory. And in fact, I think representation theory is altogether overrated in this topic, but maybe I shouldn't be, so I don't know why I should be controversial, so I'll move on. Okay? Okay. You know, I should also say that the inclusion is not entirely trivial. It is described by some operation D, but we'll get to it later. And again, I'm skipping the footnotes. And I think the next thing I want to do is to answer Anton and explain why are compositions manageable in this category. Okay? So why are compositions manageable? So here are two morphisms in our category. Okay? So a morphism is made of a scalar part, omega. So I'm just writing here as omega. It depends on both. So if, you know, if I want to compose a morphism that goes from A to B with a morphism that goes from B to C, I mean, let us first look at the first part. So the scalar, well, okay, it's a scalar. Okay, forgive me. It's just a scalar. Okay. Then there is a quadratic part, Q1, for the first morphism. And the quadratic part, well, is a quadratic in the Greek and the Latin variables. So in fact, you can decompose it into three parts. So a Greek-Greek part, F, a Greek-Latin part, E, and a Latin-Latin part, G. Okay? So basically write the quadratic Q as a sum over Eij, zeta I, z, zj, this is this part, Fij, zeta I, zeta j, and Gij, zeta, zi, zj. And then there is the perturbation piece, which is a higher degree polynomial, so quadratics I'm denoting by lines because they, well, basically each quadratic involves either two Greek letters and so it has two ends on the Greek side, or two Latin letters so it has two ends on the Latin side, and so on. And the perturbation is kind of a more complicated vertex. Okay? So suppose I have such a description for one morphism and then also for another one. And suppose I wanted to compose them, which means to glue all the Latin ends of the left with all the Greek ends of the right. And then I wanted to write the result in the same form. So a scalar, an E part, an F part, a G part, and a perturbation part. Okay? So, and one thing, remember that all of these are exponentiated. So it's not as if I have a single F line. I mean, really, the F line, you know, the true picture is that I have sort of a big sum of many F lines, including many E lines, many G lines. So everything is actually repeated with multiplicity. Okay, because it gets exponential. So exponentiated. So suppose I wanted to compose two such things. So let's start. How could I get in the output a line from left to right, so a Greek to Latin line, so line. So what would be in the output the E part? Okay? So, well, I would have to start on the left, follow an E line, get to the middle, and then either, follow an E1 line, get to the middle, and then either follow an E2 line and get out. So the first contribution will be something of the form E1 times E2. Or, well, so I start with an E line, its right end could be glued to an F line, and then if I glue it to an F line, I'd be standing here, and then this F line could be glued to a G, would be glued to a G line, and then the other end of that G line might be glued to another F line, which might be glued, whose other end might be glued to another G line, and so on. So I basically cycle around between the Fs and the Gs until eventually getting released from the loop, I mean, and by gluing the last G line to an E line. So said differently, you know, another contribution will be of the form E1 times F2 G1 E2. And then there will be another contribution, which is of the form E1 times F2 G1. So the contribution I just wrote here was you cycle once. But now I'm writing the contribution corresponding to cycling twice. So if you cycle twice, you'll get F2 G1 again E2. And if you look at it, you have a geometric series here. So the overall output is E1 times the identity minus F2 G1 inverse E2. And I hope this is the formula I wrote here. Okay? Likewise, how could you get an F in the output? So you could get an F in the output either by simply starting on the left and coming back to the left, or by going to the middle, cycling a number of times, and then coming back to the left with the essentially the transpose of E. So hence the F for the output is F1, so basically this is the comeback immediately, plus you follow E1 to go to the middle, you do a, in, well, basically you cycle a certain number of times using the
geometric
series, and then you come back to the beginning. And likewise, there is a formula for G.
Yeah. How is it? So this inverse. So you said everything converges, but that's not the perturbations.
So I said the quadratics have to be small.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And there are different smallness conditions that you can put.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, you can either insist that the f's will be small or that the g's will be small.
Mm-hmm.
And in either case, f times g is going to be small, and then 1 minus this is going to be small. So small means living in a higher degree or living in a graded space and having a higher degree,
mm-hmm.
for example. Okay? Yeah, and I agree. Yeah, it converges only if you put the appropriate conditions. Okay, then there is the scalar part. So the scalar part of the output is going to be omega 1 times omega 2, but there is yet another way to get the scalar part, which is to simply do a loop of f's and g's. And again, you can look at it and you find that the loops of f and g's are, the scalar corresponding to them is the determinant of the identity minus f2g1 inverse. Hence, this is the new omega. And finally, the perturbation is, this is the hardest bit, and I'll say it schematically, and turning it into formulas, well, can be done and is done later, but I think it's more important to see it first. Okay, so how do I get a perturbation? A contribution to P in the output. So basically, I take a number of perturbation terms from the input, so a number of perturbation terms that look like P1, a number of perturbation terms that look like P2, and then I glue them in all possible ways. So the all possible ways could be either directly or maybe via a loop or a chain of FG lines. So basically I get Feynman diagrams in which the vertices are P1 and P2, and in which the propagators are matrices that look like 1 minus F2G1 matrices that come from these arithmetic progressions. Okay? So, if you fix, so this looks like a complete mess, but if you fix if you fix the power of epsilon, it's a finite perturbation series. So these p's are always proportional to higher powers of epsilon. So if you restrict your attention to up to epsilon to the power 7, then you only need to care about Feynman diagrams with up to 7 vertices. Okay? Okay. So, I don't know if that was, if this is the right place for this, but I wanted to emphasize that this is one abstraction level up from tangles. So you see, it's tempting to think that, well, tangles also form a category, right? So tangles look like, I don't know, things like this, and they form a category by gluing them, by stacking them, okay? And you might, it's tempting to think that that sort of these boxes match with these boxes. So it's tempting to think that somehow the Greek letters correspond to the inputs of a, to the balanced of the tangle. So it's tempting to think that the Greek letters correspond to the bottom part and the Latin letters correspond to the top part. That's completely wrong. Okay, there is no, we're one level of abstraction higher. The objects that we represent here are not tangles, but morally operations between tangles. So these M and delta operations. So the tangles themselves appear within dopebdo as object, as operations, as nullary operations, as operations with no input, no inputs. So if you will compute the invariant of a tangle, the result will be a dopebdo box like this, but with only a Latin part, with no Greek part.
But that sounds really confusing. So before it was more or less clear, but this part, what do you really mean? Why do I kind of, what's the comparison at all between tangles and those?
So that's exactly what I'm trying to warn you. And, since at the end, I'm computing tangle invariants, among other things. I want to warn you that the category dopebdo is not sort of commensurate with the category of tangles. Yes?
So maybe you can do the trivial tangle, which is goes from just a straight interval from up to down.
We can do
it's
not
one
now.
But it goes to one as a Gaussian, right?
Not now. Okay.
But that makes it very clear.
Right. Can you for a moment ignore your wise remark? Because before that it was very clear. That remark is, at the moment, doesn't make any sense, but maybe probably.
But the tangle one
okay,
is
you know
right
what?
Here.
Just take it as a warning. I am not talking about the tangle category. I'm talking about one level higher, namely operations on tangles. Okay, and so no, I do, Anton. Please listen. I do want to, maybe I should repeat what I said, but I do want it said, okay? So again, tangles, so I just want to emphasize this has nothing to do with the category of tangles.
So does it have to do with the category of coordinates?
Yes. Okay. It has to do with the category of knotted handle bodies, or a virtual, or the category of rectangles. That rectangles that Roland talked about. Still, I don't want to talk about this. I want to say it's not tangles. Okay. So, and the way tangles fit in our story is as things which have only outputs. It's tangles. So this is somehow this is an algebraic version of a category of tangle operations, and the tangles themselves are the nullary operations, are operations with no inputs. So as a Dopecto box, a tangle does not correspond to something that has both Greek and Latin letters, only, but rather to something that has only Latin letters. And if you want to implement tangle composition, so tangle composition is some sort of multiplication of two tangle boxes followed by the M operation, which in itself is a big Dopecto box. So, I just wanted to. Okay, well, I don't know. Maybe I made a mess, but okay, let's move on. What did I want to say? Oh, maybe a minor comment that if you ignore the perturbation theory, the P part, what remains is sort of a very, very complete theory of the Alexander polynomial. So it's not just the Alexander polynomial, it's the sort of a multivariable generalization of the Alexander polynomial, which works for tangles as well, and which includes all tangle operations as a part of the category. So basically the EFG omega part is some generalization of the Alexander polynomial, and then the stuff beyond is beyond. Okay, in a sense, everything so far was introductions, was sort of warm, or not really introduction, but orientation. So this is now the middle of the talk, and here are my debts. So what is it good for in quantum algebra? What is it good for in knot theory? How does this inclusion, so how does this map between homomorphisms of powers of algebra to other powers of algebra into Dopecto, how does it really work? I need proofs that everything around this particular algebra really is Dopecto. Okay? It would be nice to tell you about relations with prior art, and it would be nice to complete the composition story with all the Feynman diagrams and make it more formal. Okay? So, maybe first of all, a quantum algebra example. Okay? So, at some point, Roland and I, okay, so, you know what, let me say it. So, somehow, the application here is really the fact that you have a toolbox in which you can compute all the operations that you might care about. And so it's easy to check conjectures. It's easy to verify, to check whether ideas work. Okay? So the place where I would really want to use it, or one place where I would really want to use it, is, well, I would love to go over Chevreul's talk once again. And, you know, Chevreul's talk was very, very abstract, but at the end it boils down to, you know, if you compose associators in such and such a crazy way, you get a quantization of a Lieber algebra. Okay? So, I would like to check it. I would like to make sure that I really understood him. And for this, I need a toolbox where compositions of, where all the insane compositions you could think of associators and derived quantities would make sense. So basically, it's a toolbox in which you can, or a playground, in which you can verify conjectures. And as an example, so Chevreul, I'm not there yet. It's still hard work, okay? But here is a simpler example of how you could use it. So, At some point, okay, so there is something called an integral on a Hopf algebra. And at some point, Roland and I, and later Jesse Frolich joined, conjectured that we have an explicit formula for an integral on the double of a Hopf algebra. Okay? And the explicit formula is, so if you have an element phi times or x in the double, and you have the R matrix in your, and you write it in the form sum of rho A times RA, then the formula written here is a formula for an integral. So you sum over all A's the pairing of phi times rho A with x times RA. So the conjecture has a history. Okay, it came from some commutative place. We first knew it was right because it was true in a commutative context. And then the question is, which is the correct variant of it, which is true in the non-commutative case? So really, is it phi times rho A or is it rho A times phi? Is it x times r or is it r times xa times or is it ra times x? Basically, sort of the commutative version doesn't tell you which way to order the things here. Also, when you write r, did we really mean r or did we mean r composed with the antipode? Or composed with the antipode with another variable. So all of these things would be the same in the commutative version that gave us the motivation. And so we knew that one of them should be true in the non-commutative version, but it's really, really, really hard to decide which one it is. If you try to actually follow the identities and prove and figure out which one it really is, if you don't even, you know, if you don't know which one, well, it's just hard. So the moment you have a toolbox, you can use it. So I think I stop for a moment to tell you that the toolbox is implemented in full on your handout. But anyway, now let's use it. Okay? So basically, so again, this is a translation of the previous slide to code. So basically, I am deciding what is the input. I am computing some product on the B side, some product on the A sides, and some pairing, comparing it with, basically I'm checking whether the identity holds, and I'm checking it where the B product runs over all possibilities for being left to right product or right to left product. The A product running over left to right or left to right. Basically, I'm basically checking all the possibilities. And then two of the possibilities come up, give us an answer true, and then we know exactly which version of the theorem and now we know what is actually the theorem that we want to prove. Okay. And then.
So what was the right expression?
God, I don't remember. Mm-hmm. Sorry. I don't remember.
It's S square on the second component of the R.
Yeah, there is some antipode thrown in, and yeah.
And it's actually the unit, not the co-unit. But we'll get to that later.
Okay. So, next, an example in knot theory. So, again, start from a knot. Since all the tensors, The R matrices are a part of the PECDO. Everything is a part of our language. So we can simply take the knot, the sides that we work up to epsilon squared. This is the k equals 2 here. We simply input all the ingredients, apply all the relevant multiplication tensors, hit enter to compute the answer, and we get an invariant. And I think all I wanted is to here is to emphasize that that I'm talking about actually computable things. And here is the answer tabulated for the first 20-something knots. And if you look on the web, you'll find it tabulated up to, for the whole Rolfson table.
So maybe you can point out Alexander in the denominator?
So Alexander is the stuff in black in each one of the boxes.
But in the example?
And then red is the epsilon equals 1 contribution, and blue is the epsilon equals 2. Sorry, not epsilon equals 1. The epsilon to the power 1, and blue is epsilon to the power 2.
But in the previous slide.
Checks of different crosses and checks, what are they?
I suppose a part of the point is that we have reasons to think that the invariants that you get are related to various topological properties of the knot. So it's quite clear that that if you have a knot of genus G, then it bounds the complexity of the, it bounds the degree of the invariant. So said differently, the degree of the invariant gives you a lower bound for the genus. And that's a topological property that...
So that's a theorem for epsilon equal to for epsilon first?
It's a theorem, I believe so, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a theorem.
For epsilon to the first, or for any...
No, for any epsilon. Sorry, for any power of epsilon. Mm. Okay?
But then the power of polynomial form depends on the power of epsilon.
Yeah.
But then the relation to the genus is more complicated. So.
No.
But there is a bound.
Basically, the bound is roughly that if you have a genus G, not, then, and you're looking at the power of epsilon to the k, then you get a polynomial of degree at most g times k.
Two g.
Yeah, 2g.
Something like that.
Oh, 2g times k maybe.
Something linear.
Okay. Anyway, So, this is something that ordinary quantum algebra doesn't do. So, you know, if you want to get genus bounds from the Jones polynomial, I don't think you can do it. The only other invariant that gives you genus bounds is the Alexander polynomial. And in a sense, we are perturbing around the Alexander polynomial. So we're like perturbing towards Jones, starting from Alexander. In a sense.
And Alexander, what kind of bound it gives? Because the
so the degree of the Alexander polynomial is bounded by the genus. Mm-hmm. So hence the numbers here are basically just so that you can compare. The numbers here are the genus of the knot, and then several other properties. But I started with the genus. So, and indeed, if you look at it, you will find that if the genus is high, such as here, then the polynomials are complicated. And if the genus is small, such as here, then the polynomials are much simpler. Okay? And that's a provable, so this is complicated, this is simple. And that's a provable statement. Okay? And then, There is something about unphi chirality. So a knot is called unphi chiral if it has, if it's equivalent to its mirror image. And the epsilon to the power one invariant seems to vanish for unphi chiral knots. I still don't know why this is true. There are reasons to think that there should be a relationship between these invariants and the Ripon property. And so I've listed which knots are Ripon. So for example, this knot is Ripon. But at the moment, we just don't have enough evidence. We just don't understand it enough. So you've asked, why are all these things listed? They're listed for some future time. Okay.
Okay. Well, the genus estimate is already an established result.
Yes. Established in the sense that we know why it's true. Not established in the sense that it's not written. Mm-hmm. Okay. I didn't yet tell you, and perhaps this is the most important part of the talk, or not one of the important part of the talks, how homomorphisms between powers of algebras embed into the Pedo, right? I told you what this is. Well, you know what this is. I roughly told you what is the Pedo. I didn't yet tell you how the embedding works. Okay? So that's the next chapter. So, if you remember, our algebras use both the classical and the quantum were actually four-dimensional. With generators y, b, a, and x. And also, every letter has a corresponding, so every Latin letter has a corresponding dual Greek letter. And so, the embedding works as follows. So if you're looking at a homomorphism from u to the power sigma into u to the power s, then it will correspond to a power series in Greek variables corresponding to the input tensor factors, and Latin variables corresponding to the output tensor factors. And specifically, I'm going to argue that the power series that you will get will be a docile perturbed Gaussian. So, but first, let's see why you get power series in all of these symbols. Okay? So, basically, the PBW theorem, there is a choice here, there is a choice of an ordering of the basis, and an additional result is that if you reorder bases, the result is the operators that reorder bases are also in the Pedo. So the choice doesn't really matter. Okay? But so if you choose an order for the basis of CU or QU, and my choice will always be YBAX, but you could use any other choice just as well. Then, again, PBW tells you that CU or QU are really isomorphic to, or since I'm completing, then they are isomorphic to power series rings as vector spaces, not as algebras, where the power series are power series in the variables YIDIAIXI, where I runs over all the tensor factors. Okay? So that's the point, but now I want to understand a little better homomorphisms between power series rings. In general, so basically I'm going to give a common name or a cumulative name for the YIDIAINXI and just call it the Z's. Okay, so Z stands for any of these letters. So now, suppose you have a homomorphism from power series in ZA to power series in ZB. And again, this really, you know, this really represents a homomorphism from some power of U to some other power of U. Using the pairing that we have already introduced, I'm pairing Greek with Latin letters by turning the Latin letters into differentiations with respect to the Greek letters and then substituting zero, which amounts to saying that zi to the m paired with zeta j to the n is really delta ij, so the letters must agree and the powers must agree times n factorial. So with this you get you can identify homomorphisms from power series in ZA to power series in ZB with power series in zeta A and zeta B. Okay? So basically, these homomorphisms are it's just the dual space of this tensor, that space. And the dual space of this, using the pairing, is power series in the zetas, and power series in zetas times power series in ZBs is power series in zetas and Bs. Okay? So, example. I claim that what you get here is a map D, and it maps homomorphisms into power series. And I claim that D of the identity homomorphism is the exponential of zeta times z. So if you have the identity homomorphisms between power series in z and power series in z, its d is the exponential of z zeta, of zeta z, which, if you look at it, is a value. Okay? So, many people in this room know it immediately because they've thought about Feynman diagrams and struts and things like that. Basically, I'm telling you, so e to the zeta z, you should be thinking of it as an exponential as an exponential reservoir of struts that goes from z to z, from zeta to z. And clearly, if you glue these struts to anything on the left, you don't do anything. Okay, so that's the identity map. But if you want to make it formal, you basically follow the definition, and the factorial from here cancels the factorial in the denominator in the exponentiation, and you're done. Okay. Similarly, D of the identity from U to U, this was the one variable identity, if you had one Z variable. The identity from U to U involves four variables, so Y, B, A, and X, and the identity is represented by the Gaussian e to the dual of y times y plus the dual of b times b plus the dual of a times a plus the dual of x times x. Okay? It's easy to check that. So, okay, I told you how to represent homomorphisms. Now I have to tell you what are compositions of homomorphisms. So, if you have F, which is a homomorphism from from power series in ZA to power series in ZB, and you have G, which is a homomorphism from power series in ZB to power series in ZC, then, and you want to compose their Ds, then D of the composition, so the power series corresponding to the composition, is simply, well, basically this gluing. So basically you take F, replace the Greeks by differentiations with respect, sorry, the Latins with differentiations with respect to the Greeks, apply it to G, and that's the answer.
But how is it probably, it's probably the same, but would it be like, I don't quite recall, but I think in whatever quantum mechanics, right, people have similar things, and there they would insert those exponential kernel that you have, and then integrate. I probably should amount to the same, right? Just to make comparison.
Yes. Yes. So.
Different formulas. So
there's something funny there.
Mm-hmm.
So let me write a few formulas. Okay, so assuming convergence of everything. Suppose I want to compose F with G using my composition, using our composition. So this is really F with Latins becoming differentiations with respect to Greeks evaluated on G, and all of this evaluated at zeta equal to 0. Okay? Here is a different way of writing it. So alternatively, you could write it as e to the dz d zeta acting on f times g. So remember, f has the Latin letters, and z and g has the Greek letters. So so the dz's actually act on f, and the dz's actually act on g. They act in pairs. So basically what I'm saying here, or a different way of viewing, seeing it, is to say that if you have f and g and you sum over all ways of contracting them, that's the same as putting them side by side, which is what multiplication does, and then apply all, and then apply a Laplacian here, or a differential operator like that. And of course, I still have to kill all the variables that don't get paired. So this is at zeta equals to z is equal to 0. Okay? But you see, this is really a Gaussian integration. This is a different name of Gaussian integration. To Gaussian integration. So I could have written this as the integral of f times g times the exponential of probably negative zeta z or something like that. And I took it with no matrix. If I wanted to put here a matrix of coefficients, I would probably have to invert it somewhere or something like that. Mm-hmm. But that I hope this answers your question.
Yeah.
Okay. The reason I am not mentioning Gaussian integration is because, so this is d zeta dz. The reason I'm not mentioning Gaussian integration other than in this comment is because I don't need it. I mean, why introduce something that's irrelevant? I mean, so maybe one charm of this topic is that you end up doing things like perturbation theory and Feynman diagrams in a completely algebraic context. Okay, there, everything is algebraic. Well, differentiation is really pairing. So everything here is completely algebraic. I don't need to know the word integral in order to be led to Feynman diagrams in this context. And adding integrations doesn't add anything. I don't know which. Okay. Now, by the way, if I came to here, you know, since I've already mentioned integration, even if I didn't mean to, okay, then there is a lovely kind of backhand relation with something that I said before. Okay, so you see, this is really the R matrix. Okay, and the conclusion from this formula is that pairing is related to integration after multiplication by the R matrix. And that led to the conjecture that that I mentioned before about an explicit formula for an integral on the double. So the integral on the double should be related to the pairing by a factor that has to do with the R matrix, and that became the conjecture over there. It's true in some commutative sense. This is the commutative sense, and we found that it's also true in some non-commutative sense. So this is just an oddity. Okay. Anyway, so what remains? So, well, somehow everything, the bulk of the talk remains. So I told you roughly what Dopedo is. So Dopedo is some category of Gaussian things which you compose by regarding them as differential operators. And the claim is that when you compose two such things, you get Gaussians once again, or perturbed Gaussians as necessary. I told you how, in principle, differential operators represent maps from U to U. And what remains is to show you that the maps we care about are, in fact, perturbed Gaussians. And this is false for ordinary quantum SL2. It is false in, you know, many other places. It is true for our particular case, which is this epsilon perturbation this SL2 epsilon. So,
break?
Yeah, so this is my next debt, and maybe this is indeed a good time for a break. I'm basically now here. So let's have cookies. Mm-hmm. And during cookies, discuss whether or not we continue and how much. Okay. So.
What's the plan? So what you said, kind of, could you outline a little bit what are the things the problem?
So I need to show you why everything really is Dopeldo. Mm-hmm. And the most, well, there are two or three examples that, sort of generate everything else. So I could go over those examples or not. Mm-hmm. And maybe everything else is much less significant. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is a huge list of open problems or things I don't understand, but I since you don't understand me right now, it would be pointless if I would try to go through these things I don't understand and make you not understand them even more.
Maybe come back to the tangle issue. Why these things are not tangles but operations between tangles.
Maybe, no, but I think this was, okay. Maybe we should talk about this over cookies to decide what comes next.
Let's thank her at least.